This content is brought to you by Uphold, which is a great platform that makes it easy and simple for you to buy, hold, and sell, and earn crypto. You can trade from anything to anything. For example, you can trade between cryptocurrencies and precious metals. It's an amazing platform that I've been using for years. And in fact, I still use to this day because they're, one, a great exchange, they're reputable, and they're one of the only exchanges that still lists XRP. Many of the other exchanges have delisted XRP due to the SEC lawsuit, but you can still get XRP on Uphold. So I have interviewed the CEO, the founder, and many other representatives from Uphold over the years, and I'm a fan of this platform. And once again, there's some great features like trading between different assets very easily. You don't have to convert to a currency and so forth. They're used by 10 plus million users. They have over 200 cryptocurrencies. And they have a very easy to use app. The interface is really nice. So I can certainly vouch for this platform. Once again, I've been a user for years. So if you'd like to learn more about Uphold, please visit the link in the description. Welcome back to the Thinking Crypto Podcast, your home for cryptocurrency news and interviews. With me today is Ben Edgington, who's the lead product owner at Consensus. Ben, it's great to have you on the show.
Real pleasure to be here, Tony. Thanks for the opportunity.
Ben, I'm super excited to speak with you. As I was mentioning before the recording, this week we have the Ethereum merge happening.
It's happening.
Big, yeah, you got to have that meme come up when I do the post production. You know, I'm so excited. People want to hear about the building side and, you know, how did we get to this point and all the benefits and so forth. But before we get there, I'd love to get to know you better. Tell us about your background. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, sure. So you can probably tell from my accent already, I am British. I grew up in the UK. I spent a few years in academia, ended up in sort of climate science, decided academic life was not for me long term. I jumped ship to work for a huge Japanese multinational. I spent 10 years working on supercomputers. We installed Europe's then largest supercomputer in Germany in 1999. Had a mighty 2 teraflops, which I think my desktop sitting next to me here can do today. But this was the size of a large room, plus, yeah, all the rest. And then, as is the way with large Japanese multinationals, ended up on the sort of manager track when I turned 40. And that was the normal route, and ended up in sort of modestly senior management in sort of fintech, information security area, in a head of engineering role there. And that's where I came across blockchain technology and Ethereum in particular. And it really caught my attention. Became my out of work passion hobby at that point, and then a year and a half later, so that was in early 2016, and about a year and a half later, in October 2017, I decided to make my passion my job, which I do not recommend, and joined Consensus. So I've been with Consensus for about 5 years and absolutely love working at Consensus. My caution is when you make your passion your job, it sort of never ends. It's just kind of wall to wall. You never get a break, evening or weekend. So, but yeah, that's my life now, and I love it.
That's awesome. And I could certainly relate to making, you know, your passion, your job, your career, because I made the jump to full-time crypto last year. And of course, my wife tells me, you know, you got to stop the crypto at some point, like you got to turn it off. But, you know, to your point, I mean, when it's your passion, it almost doesn't stop.
Absolutely. Yeah. My wife was like, when I said, well, shall I make this my full-time job? She was like, yeah, maybe I can have you back at weekends and evenings then, but no chance.
For sure. So I can certainly make the assumption you have Ethereum in your crypto portfolio. Do you hold anything else?
Well, For tax reasons, my wife is a big crypto holder in this family. So, but yeah, Ethereum is number one. Absolutely. I have a Mooncat, which I'm particularly fond of. It's very early NFT from 2017, I believe, and I was gifted that. But Ethereum is number one and a bunch of stable coins. But that's it.
Very cool. So I want to talk a bit about consensus, maybe just high level, and we can quickly touch on it for those who don't know, consensus and the work you all are doing on Ethereum. Can you give us a quick overview of consensus and the mission?
So consensus today is Ethereum's most significant software company. We are building products to empower the decentralized future. And the well-known products are MetaMask, Infura, Truffle. So it's a range of user-facing and developer-facing products. And also at the protocol level, we have Teku, which is my client, which is supporting the Proof of Stake network, and Besu, which is our execution client or Ethereum mainnet client, however you want to call it these days. And yeah, those are the big things, a bunch of other things around that. Consensus, of course, started, I guess, 7 years or so ago, somewhere around 2015. It's evolved quite significantly since then. So originally was like a venture studio, trying literally, I think, hundreds of different experiments with the hope that some would develop into products, useful products. And, you know, some have and many have not. It was fascinating being in that environment. We used to have a sort of motto, everything is an experiment. That used to be our sort of theme. And it was very, very wild. I mean, we tried everything, including asteroid mining, famously.
Wow. So,
but over the past 2 to 3 years, we have narrowed things down and focused on really what are the products that bring biggest value, deliver the biggest impact, and are sustainable for the future. And specifically things that empower others to build products. You know, consensus is not trying to own the whole crypto space. We are building platforms and enablers like Infura, like Truffle, like MetaMask, that allow others to do great things in this space, and indeed like our protocol products.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have been working on a lot of great things. And I have a question for you. I know consensus had acquired JP Morgan's Quorum. So is it just those two primary blockchains that consensus works on, mm-hmm. Ethereum and Quorum, or are there others as well?
Yeah, so Quorum is enterprise oriented. So you can build a private enterprise blockchain using Quorum and also Besu, which is our it's a mainnet Ethereum client, but it also has all of the privacy features and so forth to be able to build private networks as well. Consensus has also been involved with Filecoin. We're working on some layer two things like Arbitrum, Optimism. We're supporting them in various ways. We have our own in-house ZK EVM development going on currently. So there's a lot going on, but number one is the Ethereum community and supporting Ethereum. That remains the primary mission for us.
For sure. Okay, let's talk about Ethereum 2.0, the merge that's happening this week. And I'm going to ask maybe some basic questions, but I think it's important because there are a lot of new folks to the asset class and the technology that want to learn about the history and what led up to this and why is this happening. So tell us maybe if you can, the history of Ethereum from proof of work, and then why are we moving to proof of stake?
So the Ethereum network started in 2015 as a proof of work network. But even before that, around 2014, Vitalik published articles about proof of stake. And it was always a stated goal to move Ethereum to proof of stake at some point. that's what really caught my eye in early 2016 when I first got involved. I thought this proof of stake thing sounds incredible. I wanted to be part of that. There are a couple of reasons for it. One is the obvious environmental benefits. We will be using 99.95% less or even less power post when we move to proof of stake. So, yeah, 1/2000th or better than we're currently using with proof of work. But there are also security benefits to proof of stake. We just believe it's a better security model than you can achieve under proof of work, for the similar value invested, you get better security for your money. So those are the kind of key reasons we're moving to proof of stake. It's been a long journey from 2014 to now. There have been many evolutions in the thinking and planning of this. I won't necessarily call them dead ends, but you know, there have been designs which we have not pursued along the way, partly because new, better technologies have come along. So they've just enabled us to be more ambitious and to build out, an early design required stakers to put down 1,500 ETH to be a validator on the network, just because we had to limit the capacity to a few hundred participants. Now we do 32 Ether, and we have 420,000 validators on the network. So we scaled up our ambition in that sense and made it more practical for smaller stakers to become involved. So all of that has sort of taken time to feed through. We had a plan. We put down something called the Beacon Chain. So this is a proof of stake network about a year and a half ago, a bit more, December 2020. So this has been running alongside Ethereum mainnet. So Ethereum mainnet runs on proof of work. That's just kept on chugging for the last 7 years. Alongside that, a year and a half ago, we put down this proof of stake chain, the Beacon Chain, and it currently only sustains itself. It doesn't run any transactions. It's just a vehicle for proving that proof of stake works, it's secure, and building the proof of stake foundation there. It's been running flawlessly. It's got about 13 million ETH, so I don't know, $20-21 billion worth of value staked in it today. And the goal with the merge. So about a year and a half ago, one of my colleagues at Consensus, in fact, conceived the idea for the merge. How do we very quickly get Ethereum onto proof of stake? We had a much longer term plan, but he came up with this idea of taking the existing execution layer, which is all the smart contracts, all people's accounts, all of the interfaces that dApps use, and shifting them over wholesale onto the proof of stake chain, which already existed at that point. So that was Mikhail Kalinin, and he sort of architected this merge. So what we're doing, we've got the existing blockchain running, the sort of top layer, which is all of the execution, the smart contracts and everything else. And we're just swapping out the proof of work from underneath it and inserting the existing proof of stake chain. And it's that simple. just like changing the engines on a plane when you're flying. I mean, you know, should be straightforward.
How many developers are working on or with you and for this merge?
Yeah, so it's a huge distributed effort, right? And as lots of teams in lots of places, each with their own kind of goals and motivations for being involved. All in all, working on Ethereum core development, there's about 120 or so developers. You can look at Protocol Guild is basically a curated list of the full or part-time core devs on Ethereum. That's about 120. And I'd say 70 to 80% of those are somewhat involved in the merge effort itself. So getting on for 100 or so devs. And they're split amongst research teams, especially the Ethereum Foundation, also some researchers at Consensus, and client software dev teams, both on the what we used to call the ETH1 side, you know, the execution side, the traditional Ethereum clients like Geth and Besu, which is a consensus client, and Nethermind and Aragon. And then on the consensus layer side, we've got the clients like mine, Teku, trying to remember all the names, Prism, Lighthouse, Lodestar, and Nimbus, which are the five consensus clients. So amongst all of those teams and a few independent researchers, maybe around 100.
Wow. You know, at the time of the merge, do you anticipate any downtime or disruptions in transactions? You know, will there be like an anticipated downtime that everybody will know about?
So our goal is for it to be completely transparent. Yeah, if it goes well, and we have every expectation of it going well, then users and people transacting on Ethereum will not even know it's happened. You know, it will be, even if they're just sending transactions in the moment, the goal is for it to be seamless. I expect exchanges will suspend withdrawals and deposits. This is typical. This is normal for any upgrade. But yeah, anyone working on the main chain should see no difference at all. That's the goal. And it's one of the nice features about doing this merge, taking these existing components. We're taking the existing ETH1 client and just swapping out the consensus layer. So everything from the user point of view remains exactly the same. They don't know the engine's being swapped. It just keeps rolling. What could happen? What if it doesn't go well? One of the characteristics of these blockchain distributed systems is that they are highly resilient to failures. I mean, it's kind of the goal of building these things is that they are, they just keep going in the face of bad actors or failures or whatever. That is part of the design, part of the whole kind of whole point of the thing. So what we may experience is some degraded service. It's not going to stop, but we may see some missing blocks, for example, slow block times, or in the worst case, the proof of stake network might not finalize. Now, finalization is a new feature which comes with proof of stake. It's one of the security sort of additions or gains that we get with proof of stake. We normally it happens after 13 minutes and you declare a block absolutely final. The network will never revert that block, which you can never say in proof of work. There's always a chance that however deeply your block is buried, somebody will appear with a longer fork, a 51% attack they've been working on, and your block is gone. In proof of stake, we have finality, and we can say, usually after 13 minutes, that block is secure forever. It's in the history forever. If network participation drops, if a third of nodes go offline during the merge due to misconfiguration or a bug or something, then finality might be delayed. Now, not the end of the world. The chain will keep on chugging. It's just we don't get this nice property until more nodes come back online.
Exciting. I'm really excited about this because I've been staking ETH on the Beacon chain and earning some rewards that way. And I'm curious, you know, I know there's probably going to be miners who are not happy about this change, right? Because financially, they're incentivized to continue doing what they're doing. How are you guys working with these miners to maybe try to get them to, hey, take the ETH you mine and get on, you know, from a proof of stake standpoint?
Yeah, I think the mining community is made up of two different sorts of miners. And, I think there are miners who very much see themselves as part of the community. They've been contributors to Ethereum, involved for a long time, believe in the mission, reinvest their Ether into staking, for example, and generally will, come along on the journey. And Ethereum's always been moving towards proof of stake. It's not a surprise. It's been on the roadmap for a long time. People might have believed it was longer and longer out, it's taken a while, but it's always been the goal. It's been part of the DNA of Ethereum. So, I think those miners are reconciled to the change and working accordingly. And then there's a community of miners who are just kind of hash rate for hire. They'll just go to whichever chain is offering the biggest rewards. There's no loyalty. They're just service providers, and you know they'll do what they want. And we don't feel a necessity to engage with them. They've just been, you know, taking rewards when they're available, and but not actually feeding back into the ecosystem. So they can do as they wish. Yeah,
for sure. So Ethereum has had the first mover advantage. There's been a lot of building on Ethereum over the years. I just remember ICOs, your CryptoKitties, you got DeFi, you have NFTs, you got decentralized apps and so forth. And one of the challenges I'm sure I think a lot of people are aware of, there have been the gas fees, which have been very high. Mm. Will moving to proof of stake help reduce these gas fees and improve the transaction times and things along those lines?
Yeah, gas fees are quite low at the moment, but they have been much higher, as you rightly say. So the merge itself will not significantly change throughput or gas prices. So this, yeah, we need to make this a kind of banner headline, because I think a lot of people still have in mind that this is the full delivery of Ethereum 2.0 and this changes everything. No, it doesn't. This is only at this stage about the move to proof of stake and getting Ethereum off proof of work onto proof of stake. Now, it does lay a foundation for the parallel work that we're doing in improving scalability. So Ethereum scalability is now all about roll-ups and layer two solutions. Mm. And we have a bunch of stuff at the protocol level, which is, you know, pipelined behind the merge to deliver, which will increase the effectiveness of roll-ups, you know, give them 100x, 1000x better performance. But that's not the merge. I mean, that's the merge is the first step. And then over the, you know, 6 months, year and a half after the merge, we will be incorporating those advances into the core protocol, and then the roll-ups will get the benefit of that. So layer two is where the scaling is, and, you know, people concerned about gas fees and so forth, that's the place to go. You know, seriously investigate the Optimisms, the Arbitrums, the ZK Syncs, the Starkwares, and all of that of this world. That's the future, secured by the base chain. The Ethereum base chain secures everything, offers them the maximally decentralized, censorship resistant security, but the applications in future will sit on the upper layers.
That's interesting, and I appreciate you clarifying that, because I think folks sometimes miss the layer twos, and they think, well, could Ethereum lose market share and adoption despite its first mover advantage because of the Solanas of the world, the Cardanos? And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but those are thoughts and questions that are put out there. So it's interesting. And to your point, you're going to focus more on the scalability and the transaction items in phase two after the merge.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening now. I mean, these L2s exist, and they are offering, you know, transactions for pennies. I mean, it's available today, but they are still slightly limited. You know, if they want to scale by 100x from where they are today, then they need some more support from the base layer. So this is what we want to work towards over the next couple of years. And then we're looking at, you know, huge scalability in the system as a whole. You know, it's not all about the base chain anymore. The base chain, yeah, in some ways fades into the background, which is perfect. I mean, it's infrastructure for the planet, and infrastructure should be in the background. You shouldn't be kind of like, you know, seeing it and interacting with it every day. That's the supporting network. And then we're building layers on top of that, which the users interact with very cheaply, very quickly, and because of the base layer, very securely.
For sure. I wonder if you could walk through, you know, let's say there's someone new to crypto and they bought some Ethereum, and they're listening and like, oh, okay, move to proof of stake. Can you walk us through what they could do in order to earn staking rewards, and what those staking rewards percentages would be, you know, as far as APY and things like that?
So There's a range of useful things you can do. So the gold standard is to run your own node. Now, to do that, you need 32 Ether. That's the minimum stake, which is quite a high bar these days. But if you are blessed to be able to get your hands on that, then running your own node is very feasible. I run a node from home. I'm on a very poor network, and I've got a little box that cost me a few hundred dollars, and it's been chugging away for the last year and a half and performing perfectly. So very reasonable to do. And there are plenty of staking guides out there. And there are things like DAP node. Just struggling, reaching for the name there, which are basically one-click install devices, and you can be up and running with your stake pretty quickly. So that's the sort of gold standard, and that decentralizes the network maximally. Slightly behind that is something pooled staking, like Rocket Pool. Rocket Pool is decentralized staking, which you can join. I forget what the lower limit is, but something like 0.1 ETH or something like that. And you pool your staking with others to reach the 32 ETH threshold, and it's run by an operator, and it's guaranteed by smart contract infrastructure on the Ethereum mainnet. And they've worked very hard to make it maximally decentralized. So that's a really good solution if you haven't got the 32 ETH, and basically you buy our ETH, which is the Rocket Pool liquid staking derivative, as part of that you get our ETH, and then you can stake that in and DeFi and stuff like that. And then moving along the spectrum a bit, there's Lido, which is a big staking aggregator. They've got about 20 plus operators behind them. They're a huge operation on Ethereum, on the staking network. They actually control about a third of the stake, which is a little concerning. They're not, there are different views on this. It looks quite centralized because it's a single DAO that essentially manages that stake, but actually is run. The data centers running the validators are very, very distributed across 22 plus, might be 29 now, in fact, different operators. So Lido has staked ETH. STETH is a liquid staking derivative. And, when you stake with Lido, you get that, and you can put that into DeFi and stuff as well. And they're moving all the way to the kind of far end, the slightly less desirable end of the spectrum is, you can go to Coinbase and you can click the stake my ETH button and just forget all about it. And that's not, honestly speaking, that's not really helping the network. I mean, that's not adding to the decentralization of the network or the resilience of the network in any sort of meaningful way. But it's an option. And, for the privilege, Coinbase will take, I think, 25% of your staking rewards. Whereas if you solo stake or you then everything is yours. And in terms of return, I think you get several different sorts of return. So currently, pre-merge, validators on the Beacon chain get rewards for their protocol activity. That's making blocks and that's voting on blocks, and it's running about 4% per year in ETH terms. Post-merge, validators also get the transaction fees from transactions they include in blocks. So just as miners today get transaction fees, I think we call them miner tips. I always forget what the current technology is on that one, but what's left after the base fee is burnt is goes to the miner. Validators will receive those. That will be another 2 or 3 percentage points above your 4%. And then there is opt-in MEV, minor extractable value, or maximal extractable value, which is extra income you can gain from ordering transactions in the block. So sandwich attacks, arbitrage, and so forth. And we have a block builder network has sprung up to provide MEV ready blocks. And so block builders will bid to validators and say, I will give you X ETH to include my block. And another block builder will say, I'll give you Y ETH to include my block. And then you can choose the one which is most profitable for you. And there are some estimates out, that's probably another couple of percentage points on your yield. So looking at something like a maximum about 8% per annum.
Wow. That's certainly a strong incentive. And what we're seeing, I've been seeing reports at least, just this morning, I saw one from Bank of America saying Ethereum's move to proof of stake, the merge happening, will bring in more institutional investors and builders on Ethereum. Are you guys anticipating, you know, more adoption? Can you talk a bit about what this opens up as far as adoption and building?
Yeah, I think the proof of work narrative has become very bad for blockchains. And, you know, I think our move to proof of stake is very timely. The environmental narrative has been pretty toxic over the last year or so. And I'm, you know, I'm delighted to be part of making that move. And I think that has been a problem for users, brands in particular, who want to build on Ethereum. Have received a lot of pushback from users because of the just the power consumption, the carbon footprint. And you know, we are looking to reduce that by a factor of 2,000 or more with the move to proof of stake. Essentially, it becomes negligible, right? We take away all of the proof of work mining burn on that. So I think that will make it a much more palatable story for brands and institutions who wish to get involved with Ethereum. So yeah, definitely a better narrative around that. And yeah, I very much hope it will encourage more adoption. I mean, we're all about openness. We're all about being a platform which is permissionless. Anyone can come and build anything on Ethereum. We want to remove as many barriers to that as we possibly can. Look forward to, you know, supporting the decentralized future.
And I'm assuming you guys are anticipating there's going to be big institutions looking to stake as well, right? I mean, to your point, that proof of work energy narrative is now off the table. They don't have to worry about that or that risk. And now they have a financial incentive to come stake as well.
Yeah, it will definitely be interesting to see the you know, the execution risk of the merge being behind us later this week will, I think, definitely help. At some stage, we need to put in withdrawals. We need to implement that. So currently, if you stake, your stake is still locked. Even with the merge, you're still not able to unstake it meaningfully. So within some months, I mean, we're still debating as devs, you know, the exact timing on that. Within some months, you'll be able to unstake. That will be the ultimate de-risking for institutions, I think, who may be nervous about locking up their assets for an indeterminate length of time, you know, at the whim of the core devs. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, I can see it becoming mainstream. It's essentially an internet bond. I mean, it's, you know, it's basically essentially risk-free returns for staking into the protocol generated by the protocol.
Yeah. I'm excited to see, you know, who are some of these institutions that are going to make that big jump. I want to talk NFTs and NFTs on Ethereum. Certainly the NFT market has boomed and we've seen just a lot of different types of artworks. And then we see big brands now starting to build NFTs. We know that we're still in the early stages. So are you guys anticipating a lot more building of NFTs on the Ethereum blockchain? And, you know, are you prepared to handle that, you know, the volume and all those things?
Yeah. Again, I mean, layer two's to the rescue. A lot more is happening on, you know, the non-base chain, which is the right thing to do. NFTs have been fascinating, right? I mean, this, I think, it's been really interesting to see a world that is mysterious to me, the sort of art world, the collectibles world, you know, coming intersecting with my sort of techie blockchain world. And yeah, I get the impression that the blockchain technology is just not really interesting to them. And, you know, this is perfect, right? This is what success looks like. They don't care what the technology underlying it is, as long as, you know, they benefit from the decentralization, the permissionlessness, the robustness of the network. And for me, that's what success looks like for Ethereum, for a blockchain. It's just in the background. Users don't even know they're running on it, but they gain the benefits of it. And it's been absolutely fascinating to see this world develop. It's not my world. I kind of keep an eye on it and, you know, sometimes see some of the things going on there. I would never have anticipated it would become so huge, but it's really, really interesting. And I think has a future. Digital scarcity, you know, that's what blockchains are about. It's a thing, and people are waking up to that.
So a question for you, and I don't know if you can speak much to it, but right now, let's say I go to OpenSea and I'm building NFTs on the Ethereum blockchain. I'm transacting it with the Ether currency, right? To your point of layer twos, how are you guys, let's say like Polygon Matic, how will the switch over happen? Will it be like, okay, these NFT marketplaces will eventually integrate the layer twos and highlight that this is a layer two on top of the Ethereum blockchain? Like, I'm just trying to put those things together. And I don't know if my question is off base.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to OpenSea today, all of my NFTs, whether on Polygon or on Ethereum, are listed. And I didn't do that. They just automatically pick it up, right? So it's happening. This sort of ecosystem where we have multiple L2s built on an L1 and you have to choose your L2, this is being abstracted away by the front ends, and that's absolutely the right thing to do. In the same way, you know, I can use a website and I have no idea where it's hosted, what hardware it's running on, and, you know, how many machines are serving my web page and whatever. I don't know. I don't care. And in the same way, yeah, the front ends and the protocols that are being built on the application level protocols will abstract away all of this complexity. There will be bridges that automatically bridge your ETH from one chain to another. You don't need to worry about moving it over and so on. It's today it's not what it will be. You know, it's clunky. You can see the joins and so on, but already with something like OpenSea, we're getting there, and it's becoming a more seamless user experience, and that's only going to improve as we get more familiar with the tech, as more, you know, user oriented people come into the system and build more usable systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great point. You know, people are not going to care. They just want it to work. And it's kind of like the pipeline of the existing internet. You don't care about the HTTP protocol and the headers and all that stuff and what server and this server and that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough that the first web browser I used was an in-terminal text based web browser. And that was clunky. When Mosaic came along with built-in graphics, I mean, you know, this was world-changing. And we haven't had our Mosaic moment yet. I think, you know, our usability kind of singularity. But it will happen. We're still at the sort of clunky VT terminal-based development stage of blockchain stuff, and users are coming along and expecting that it's easier to use, and it isn't, and that's kind of, you know, our fault, but it will be, you know, it's going to be much smoother, and it's, you know, the experience will be as seamless as browsing on your phone. I mean, you know, one of these days
for sure. A question just came to mind, and I've been talking to other projects and so forth, and there's central banks that are building CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. A lot of people are not fans necessarily, but it's happening, right? And I'm curious if Ethereum has been piloted or you've been approached by central banks where these CBDCs could be tested on the Ethereum blockchain.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating, wouldn't it? I think more likely is somehow stablecoins on Ethereum getting folded into national economies, getting recognized potentially as, I won't say necessarily legal tender, but as a sort of proxy for legal tender, perhaps. In the UK, there have been some murmurings about this, some interesting moves into perhaps putting some reasonable regulation around stablecoins that will make them, you know, part of our normal economy. You know, I would like to be able to pay my taxes in DAI. You know, that would be a massive milestone. So I think that's more likely than a full CBDC being built on Ethereum. And I say that because the premise of Ethereum is that it is fully permissionless, fully censorship resistant, and so forth, where governments actually really want to retain control. So whilst they could build it, I'm skeptical that they will.
It just came to mind. That would probably be the Quorum solution, right? Privacy and more enterprise. So that they would probably want to try it on there versus Ethereum, to your point.
Right. Likely, I think, to be per country closed systems. We'll have to see how it goes. We'll see how Britcoin gets developed. They were talking about Britcoin a lot a year ago, but it's gone quiet on that front lately.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it seems like there's discussions, all these central banks are talking about it, and we'll see where it goes. Certainly a lot of people are concerned about the privacy aspect, right? And that government's going to control your money to another level and everything that you buy and sell. But that's a whole other conversation. On the note of regulations, I know you guys just got a new prime minister who, from what we've seen in her tweets, is crypto friendly. And we know the United States is still trying to figure out crypto regulations. What are your thoughts on how things have been going, I guess, globally, or with at least the superpowers of getting crypto regulations right?
Yeah, I'm quite encouraged to see some of the noises coming out of the UK government over the last year, some general positivity towards crypto. And interestingly, you know, we had this Brexit thing a while back. I think there's a desire to differentiate ourselves from the European Union to an extent. And one way, while the European Union seems to be bringing in some quite heavyweight legislation around crypto, there seems to be a desire in the UK to sort of differentiate from that and be more innovative, to enable, you know, more innovation on crypto and just generally be more hands-off on the regulation. So that's looking interesting. I'm intrigued. Everyone talks all the time about the US legislation. And actually, I think that's a sign that we're not yet where we want to be. I mean, I think there's a danger for Ethereum, for blockchains in general, where one economy, one legislature dominates. And, you know, what happens in that legislature affects the whole chain. That shows we're not properly decentralized, right? We need to be more resilient than that. And I understand, you know, US as you know, one of the largest or the largest global economy is always going to have an outsized influence. But we do seem to spend an inordinate amount of time talking about what the SEC is going to do. And, you know, I'm sitting here in the UK thinking, why do I care? I mean, is it a security? Is it a commodity? Why do I care? And but people seem to get very, very vexed about this in the States. And it has this sort of outsized, dominates the narrative in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it's a big, big conversation happening, and we'll see how things go. There's some big events and meetings happening here, at least with Gary Gensler, chair of the SEC, and members of Congress. But to your point, you're on the building side and you just want to make sure it works. So I could certainly understand that. You guys are heads down building. I want to get your thoughts on, big institutions that are entering the market. And we kind of touched on this with enterprises and so forth. We just had BlackRock, world's largest wealth manager, enter the market. Could they be eventually staking on the Ethereum blockchain, right? What are your thoughts on how the market has grown, given that you got in 2016? We're now in another league compared to what happened, you know, years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being part of something that a platform that supports hundreds of billions of dollars of economic activity is, I mean, I guess it was sort of always the end goal, but it sort of surprises you that it's happening, right? I mean, sort of looking back, I mean, we've always pitched Ethereum as the settlement layer for the planet. I mean, that's, you know, there have been a bunch of ways we've looked at it, the world computer and so on. But, you know, one of the consistent strands has been settlement layer for the planet, the ultimate kind of high court, as it were, underpinning, you know, global economies. And so, you know, at the back of the mind has always been the scale of ambition. It has to be, by its very nature, supporting trillions of dollars of economic activity in the end game, if that's going to be true. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but it does, you know, feel slightly crazy. We've got this ragtag band of 100 or so plus, you know, core devs, loosely coordinated. We're not... our processes are evolving, our roadmap is evolving, we're just kind of trying to do the best we can. We're not sitting there thinking, right, I want to build a $1 trillion network, how am I going to do it? Right. It is fascinating how it's been a sort of build it and they will come scenario. I mean, I think it will go from strength to strength. We're cautious in Ethereum world. We evolve and deliver slowly. Some people get very frustrated by that, but you know, it's caution. We desperately do not wish to break anything, but on the other hand, we're ambitious. We're not as cautious as Bitcoin, which is basically takes their protocol that it's frozen as a virtue. We don't see that as a virtue. We want to evolve and, you know, add capacity and add capability to it, but we do it in a way that we believe is sustainable and, you know, promotes the values of decentralization, censorship resistance, permissionlessness, and, you know, and reliability, robustness. You know, we don't actually break anything. So yeah, it's a fascinating balance. I mean, I absolutely love being part of this community for all those reasons. You know, it feels like doing something important, but also there's this terrific interplay between all the devs working on the same problems sort of independently. I'm, you know, thrilled that consensus is part of this. And, you know, as I was going to say put a stake in the ground, but that's a bit of an awful pun. But, you know, has invested in supporting the Ethereum protocol in the form of Teku, which is the staking client, which, yeah, my team has developed, and Besu, which is our execution client, which, you know, that team has developed. And we offer this to the world as public goods, freely licensed and, you know, free to use and support. And, you know, anyone can get involved and make PRs and we welcome it.
For sure. All right, I got some wrap-up questions here for you. First, rapid fire. What's your favorite food?
Indian, absolutely. No question.
Favorite musician or band?
Dave Brubeck Quartet. Do you even know who they are?
No.
1950s, 1960s, jazz combo. Did lots of very innovative stuff with polyrhythm and polyphonics. Great. Absolutely brilliant.
I will definitely check it out. I love music. I play guitar, so I will definitely check it out. Favorite movie?
Favorite movie, Terminator 2. When I first saw it, mind blowing. You know, first real CGI thing that came out, and it was just mind blowing.
It's one of my favorites, and my wife makes fun of me if it's on TV. I just sit and I watch it, and she's like, "Haven't you seen this movie like 10,000 times?" Yeah,
it's brilliant.
Yeah, favorite book.
Favorite book. I'll give you a favorite author. Very British, very English. P.G. Woodhouse writes very lightweight, very funny novels, wrote, I should say, and, you know, in the 1930s, 40s and 50s, about the life of hapless British aristocrats. And they're just very funny and beautifully written. And if I want to just escape from everything and have something which is kind of weightless to read, that's P.G. Wodehouse is my go-to.
Awesome. And when you're not working at Consensus, or even anything crypto, what are you doing as a hobby?
As a hobby, I am a musician. I play saxophone. I kind of got out of the habit a bit over lockdown and things, so I wasn't able to kind of meet with the band, so need to kind of pick that up again. So a bit out of practice, but and then trying to get out into the big wide world a bit more, hiking and walking. Just had a week away doing some hiking in Wales, and I love that, just getting out into nature.
Awesome. And final question for you: if you could create your own metaverse, what would the theme be?
A themed metaverse. I guess this is probably not a very exciting answer, but I think probably Star Trek, original, boldly going where no one has gone before. And I just love that Federation vision, you know, just this. It's fantastic.
Mine would be Star Wars, like it's anything space related, Star Wars. I would be in the metaverse all day.
Fabulous.
Ben, pleasure chatting with you. Exciting week ahead, and I'm looking forward to the merge.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. And absolutely. It's nervous times. We just got like 2.5 days to go, 60 hours or something, and it's going to happen. So, very much looking forward to it. Thanks for the opportunity to join your podcast, Thinking Crypto, and enjoy talking to you.